Imagine it is 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday.
Right.
A coordinated cyber attack has just completely locked down your city's payroll system. A wildcat strike has emptied out the municipal water treatment plant. And, a Category 4 hurricane is 12 hours offshore, churning straight toward the coast.
The perfect storm, literally.
Exactly. And you cannot simply put a closed for maintenance sign on a city. You have to fix the engine while the car is doing 80 miles an hour.
Yeah, the private sector has a massive luxury in a crisis, honestly. They can simply reduce demand to match their temporarily reduced capacity. Like a retail chain can just shut down 50 branches and put a nice apology on their website.
Right, totally.
But government agencies, municipalities, emergency services, they do not have a pause button. I mean, if they stop, the consequences cascade immediately into threats to public safety, infrastructure collapse, and, well, severe impacts on vulnerable populations.
Today, we are looking at the exact blueprint of how society avoids that total collapse. So in this deep dive, we are unpacking a really comprehensive guide published by Regional Supplemental Services, or RSS Inc., and it's titled Contingency Planning for Government Agencies.
It is a fascinating read.
It really is. Our mission today is to uncover the hidden frameworks that keep the gears turning when the world goes sideways for you, and to show you the vast difference between just throwing your hands up to react to an emergency versus having a structured, battle-tested continuity plan.
Yeah, that difference is huge.
Okay, let's unpack this. To figure out how to save the system, we first need to understand the structural pillars of that system. The RSS guide builds this around four non-negotiable elements.
Right, the four pillars: essential functions, staffing continuity, facility and tech, and finally, authority and communications.
And those have to work together,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. They have to move in total synchronization.
Yeah.
But the trap that most agencies fall into immediately is treating all of their daily operations as, equally important.
Like everything is an emergency.
Exactly. In a severe disruption, treating everything as a priority generates massive operational friction. You need a ruthless hierarchy that separates the absolutely mission-critical work from the work that is important, but ultimately deferrable.
The guide structures this into a five-tier essential function hierarchy, which creates a fascinating look at how triage actually works at a municipal level.
Right, the tiering system.
Yeah, so tier one is immediate essential, like emergency response, public health alerts. Tier two is time-sensitive essential, which might withstand a few hours of delay, but not a prolonged outage. Think payroll or safety permitting.
And then you get into the lower tiers.
Exactly. Tier three is legally required, like court-mandated hearings. Tier four is public-facing support, your standard service counters. And finally, tier five is deferrable administrative work, routine reporting, long-term internal projects, that kind of thing.
It sounds incredibly logical on paper.
But let's look at the human element here, because you are dealing with department heads whose entire careers are built around their specific domains. If a crisis hits, isn't every single director going to storm into the command center and demand that their department's operations remain fully funded and staffed?
Oh, 100%.
It just seems like a recipe for a massive turf war when you try to tell the Parks Department that their work is suddenly tier five.
And that instinct for self-preservation is exactly why this tiering system has to be codified, legally reviewed, and signed off on long before there's even a cloud in the sky. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this five-tier classification creates a defensible, common operating language.
Defensible is a good word for it.
Right, because when the storm hits, executive leadership isn't debating the value of the Parks Department's monthly newsletter versus, debris removal. They're simply executing a pre-approved framework.
So it takes the emotion out of it.
Exactly. The city manager can point to the document and allocate scarce resources objectively. It bypasses the departmental egos entirely
Yeah.
because the hierarchy dictates the response, not the loudest, most panicked voice in the room.
That neutralizes the politics of an emergency beautifully.
Yeah.
But identifying those essential tasks is only the first step, because even if everyone agrees on what tier one operations are, those functions fail the second you lack the people to execute them.
Without a doubt.
And as the guide lays out, staffing continuity is consistently the weakest, most underdeveloped link in public sector planning.
It's staggering, really. Agencies will spend millions of dollars building structurally reinforced command centers and installing redundant fiber optic networks, but they will completely neglect the workforce side of the equation.
Just totally overlook it.
Yeah, and the sheer variety of staffing risks is huge. Severe weather is the obvious one, but agencies are just as vulnerable to sudden labor disputes, massive public health events, budget delays, or even a sudden wave of retirements hitting a specialized department all at once.
And the symptom is always the same, right? Empty desks and vacant heavy machinery.
Right. And a very common, almost reflexive response from management is to assume they can just shuffle people around. Like, oh, the sanitation driver called out sick. Have the administrative assistant from Public Works drive the truck today.
Relying purely on cross-training is like asking your hospital accountant to perform surgery just because they both work in the same building.
That is a perfect analogy.
I mean, assuming cross-training will save you is like expecting a city bus driver to jump into a 10-ton municipal snowplow during a blizzard just because both vehicles happen to have a steering wheel.
Yeah, they don't know the blind spots, they aren't certified for the complex hydraulic controls, and they have no idea what the plow routes are.
Exactly.
The friction of implementation in the public sector makes that kind of ad hoc cross-training incredibly dangerous, if not entirely illegal. Public sector roles operate inside a web of strict regulatory constraints.
Red tape, basically.
Necessary red tape, but yes. You are dealing with specific site familiarities, rigorous safety and OSHA training, mandatory background checks, and rigid union awareness. You cannot just place a random municipal employee into a water testing facility and expect them to safely manage the chemical treatments.
And this is exactly where the RSS Inc. solution completely changes the operational reality.
It really does.
Because they operate as a pre-planned rapid workforce support partner. The crucial distinction is that they are integrated into the agency's continuity plan before the disruption escalates.
Right, before the panic sets in.
Yeah, we are not talking about calling a generic temp agency in a panic. RSS supplies highly specialized, high-stakes labor. They provide CDL drivers, heavy machine operators, CNC operators, production, and warehouse workers.
It's a very specialized bench.
Right. And they even deploy strike replacement workers, strike security, to ensure critical infrastructure stays online during labor disputes.
What's fascinating here is the mechanism of how RSS works. The true value isn't merely the physical presence of temporary labor, it is the absolute readiness to deploy into labor-sensitive environments.
Because the admin side is a nightmare.
Oh, it's impossible. Consider the immense administrative friction of trying to onboard emergency personnel. When a crisis strikes, an agency's human resources department is usually offline, overwhelmed, or physically displaced.
Think about trying to hire 50 commercial truck drivers at 3 o'clock in the morning during a state of emergency.
You just can't.
If an agency tries to do that themselves, they are pulling DMV reports, running comprehensive background checks, verifying medical paperwork, and trying to secure commercial insurance, all while the city is actively flooding. It is an impossible bottleneck.
And RSS absorbs that entire bottleneck. Because they're a fully licensed and insured nationwide partner, that administrative heavy lifting is already done.
So they just walk in ready to go.
Exactly. They manage the workers' compensation, the disability insurance, the employment verification, and the payroll constraints. The agency simply activates the contract, and the specialized workforce arrives ready to operate.
That is huge.
It allows the municipal leadership to focus strictly on public safety instead of drowning in HR or paperwork.
Okay, so we've mapped our essential functions, and we have RSS standing by with specialized workers ready to deploy.
Yeah.
But who actually pushes the go button?
Ah, the million-dollar question.
Right, because if the city charter dictates that only the mayor or the chief procurement officer can authorize emergency spending, and that person is unreachable, the entire beautifully designed plan instantly falls apart.
And it does fall apart. Often.
This brings us to the third pillar. Command, control, and the red tape of reality.
Decision authority is where theoretical plans often shatter against reality. In normal, day-to-day government operations, the chain of command is intentionally slow.
Because of transparency, right?
Yes. It is designed around public accountability, transparency, and thoroughness. But during a catastrophic disruption, that normal process becomes a lethal bottleneck. If your continuity plan requires a 3-person committee review to approve emergency overtime pay, your response will collapse before it even begins.
To combat this, the guide details the rule of three for authority. Every essential department must pre-designate a primary lead, the person legally authorized to activate the plan and approve actions.
Right.
But they critically need an alternate one and an alternate two, along with a heavily documented escalation path.
Mm.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, lay it on me.
What happens if a massive localized disaster hits and the single person holding the legal authority to hire those RSS strike replacement workers is currently stuck on a cruise ship in the middle of the ocean without Wi-Fi?
Without the rule of three, the answer is devastatingly simple. Nothing happens.
Wow. Nothing.
Nothing. The city waits, the infrastructure degrades, and the crisis deepens. Succession planning is the armor of the activation plan. A continuity strategy that names only a single decision maker is just a single point of failure disguised as a plan.
That is a terrifying thought.
It is. The alternate escalation paths ensure that if the primary lead is unreachable, alternate one possesses the immediate, legally recognized authority to step in and authorize the deployment.
And we really need to dig into the friction of that legal authority. Emergency conditions do not magically erase public accountability.
They absolutely do not.
A hurricane does not suspend collective bargaining agreements or civil service rules. You can't just start handing out blank checks or ignoring union contracts because the situation feels urgent.
And that is a critical tension in government planning. A contingency plan that attempts to bypass statutory constraints will create catastrophic legal and financial exposure for the municipality once the dust settles.
You solve the flood, but drown in lawsuits.
Exactly. You might fix the immediate emergency, but you will bankrupt the agency in lawsuits and federal penalties a year later. That is exactly why legal and procurement officers must be embedded in the planning stage.
So it's not about legal throwing up roadblocks to make the plan less practical.
Far from it. Their role is to define the boundaries of emergency purchasing authority in advance. They need to pre-negotiate how overtime rules apply when public works staff are forced into 18-hour shifts.
Right. Get it all in writing early.
Yes. They ensure that the contracts with partners like RSS Inc. are structured to comply with competitive procurement laws before the crisis hits, so that activating them is a legally protected maneuver, not a desperate gamble.
Okay, we have the people, we have the legal authority to deploy them, and we know our priorities. But we operate in a deeply digital ecosystem.
We certainly do.
Modern infrastructure relies on constant connectivity. What happens when the tools themselves vanish? We're looking at the fourth pillar, facility and tech, and the reality of the digital dark age.
The mistake agencies make here is treating technology continuity purely as an IT problem. It is fundamentally an operational survival issue.
Not just broken computers.
Exactly. The systems we are talking about run the emergency alerts, the dispatch case management, the permitting, and the fleet tracking. If the digital system goes dark, the physical operation stops.
And the risks are everywhere now.
Right. The risks aren't just limited to regional power failures. It is targeted ransomware, network infrastructure attacks, or the sudden failure of a third-party vendor platform that your agency relies on.
Let's look at how that actually plays out. Imagine a county's foster care system gets hit with a targeted ransomware attack.
A nightmare scenario.
Total nightmare. The IT department assesses the damage and say, hey, don't panic. We have off-site backups. The cloud servers will be completely scrubbed and restored in exactly 72 hours.
Okay, 72 hours.
In a scenario like that, if the IT department promises to restore the cloud servers in 3 days, shouldn't the agency just tell the public to wait? Why bother designing and training the staff on clunky paper and pen offline workflows?
I mean, if you were operating a retail logistics hub, you could perhaps afford to wait. But when dealing with public sector operations, waiting 72 hours is often fatal. This raises an important question, which is the blind spot of confusing technology recovery with service continuity.
They sound similar, but they aren't.
They're two entirely different timelines.
Because in those 72 hours, the real world doesn't stop.
Precisely. You have vulnerable children who require emergency placement tonight. The IT department's recovery timeline is 72 hours, but the public's survival timeline might be 3 hours.
Wow.
Service continuity means having a secure lockbox of physical paper forms, pre-printed procedural manuals, and burner phones ready so social workers can legally and safely place those children immediately, entirely outside of the digital database.
That distinction is phenomenal. Technology recovery versus service continuity. If you've ever tried to get an urgent building permit to stabilize a structure before a storm, and the clerk tells you, sorry, the system is down, you are experiencing a tier 2 continuity failure in real time.
Yes, exactly.
The manual workaround, even if it's literally runners carrying paper forms between floors of a municipal building, is what bridges the gap. It keeps the engine running while IT rebuilds the digital car.
And cyber-related contingency planning has to involve concrete decision rules. Leaders need to know the threshold for deliberately taking their own systems offline to stop a virus from spreading, and they need the offline architecture in place to ensure critical services do not go black just because the screens do.
Okay, we've built an incredible framework. We've mapped our essential functions into 5 tiers. We've secured rapid response staffing through RSS Inc. We have a deep bench of legal authority using the rule of 3, and we've built robust manual workarounds.
That's a solid plan.
It is. We have a thick, meticulously documented binder sitting on a shelf in the Emergency Operations Center. How do we ensure that binder doesn't instantly shatter into a million pieces upon impact with a real-world disaster?
By breaking it yourself, repeatedly.
Break your own plan.
Yes. An untested plan is nothing more than a series of highly optimistic assumptions. And acting on unverified assumptions during a crisis gets people hurt. Agencies must subject their plans to rigorous operational exercises.
Like fire drills, but way bigger.
We're talking about realistic tabletop simulations and staffing drills that aggressively target the plan's weaknesses.
The RSS guide highlights some incredibly specific exercise scenarios that agencies need to run. It's not just, what if it rains?
Right, that's too simple.
It's running a simulation where you lose physical access to your primary facility for 5 consecutive business days. Or suddenly dealing with an unannounced, unexplained absence of 30% of your Tier 1 essential employees.
And that's where the plan falls apart.
Let's walk through how a tabletop exercise like that actually fails, because it exposes a major trap. The reliance on static checklists. So what does this all mean? We spend all our lives being told to make checklists, but you're saying a checklist can actually blindside you in a complex crisis?
Yes. The static checklist is incredibly dangerous in a complex crisis because it assumes a linear problem. A checklist is built for a scenario where A happens, so you do B.
Right.
But real-world disruptions are defined by compounding variables. Let's say you run a tabletop exercise for a severe winter storm. The storm causes a facility closure. The checklist says to shift staff to remote work.
Makes sense so far.
But the storm also causes a localized network outage, so remote work is impossible. Simultaneously, you face a severe staff shortage because your RSS emergency workers are delayed by the road closures.
Ah. So if you are blindly following a checklist designed for a clean, isolated power outage, the compounding variables will completely paralyze you.
Exactly.
You hit step 3 on the list, find out it's impossible, and the whole response freezes. What is the alternative?
The superior approach is abandoning the rigid script and adopting decision criteria. Instead of a list of mandated actions, you equip your leadership with a framework of guiding questions.
Like what kind of questions?
Like what minimum service level protects public safety in this exact hour? Or which specific roles must be physically filled within the next 24 hours to prevent infrastructure damage? Or which emergency resources require immediate procurement authorization?
It's a framework for thinking dynamically rather than a script for acting mechanically. It treats the municipal leaders like intelligent decision makers navigating a fluid environment.
Exactly. It also prevents a massive systemic risk called overactivation. Not every disruption requires a full multi-agency emergency posture.
Right. You don't need the National Guard for a pothole.
Exactly. If you treat a localized software glitch with the same rigid checklist you use for a Category 5 hurricane, you are instantly wasting precious taxpayer resources and burning out your staff on a false alarm. Decision criteria allow leaders to scale their response accurately to the actual ground-level threat.
So, to bring this all together for you listening, successful government contingency planning requires a profound shift in mindset. It isn't just about having an emergency binder.
No, it is a living process.
Right. It requires ruthlessly tiering your essential functions so you know exactly what to say first without the political turf wars. It means securing rapid response staffing partners like RSS Inc. long before the disaster strikes so you can bypass the HR bottleneck at 3 in the morning.
Crucial step.
It requires establishing deep, redundant benches of legal authority, building offline manual workarounds for when the digital world goes dark, and replacing linear checklists with flexible decision criteria that have been pressure tested through punishing simulations.
And think about your own environment, whether it's your team, your business, or the systems you rely on every day. If 30% of your essential resources vanished tomorrow morning and your primary digital systems went permanently offline, do you have a flexible decision framework to keep moving forward? Or are you relying on an outdated checklist that assumes the world will simply cooperate with your plan?
A terrifying but absolutely necessary question to ask before the storm hits. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden mechanisms of public sector resilience. We hope it helps you look a little closer at the systems around you, and we'll see you next time. Remember, the car is moving. Make sure you know how to change the tire.